to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between everything going on in our world and how it affects our health, food, and environment. We look at public policy. We look at what's going on in the body politic. We look at what's going on with our food, water, air, and earth, and how government policies, legislation, regulations, social actions, and political movements affect all of the things that lead to and connect to our health. I'm originally a long-standing health journalist who broadened my view and began covering the environment as well as policy and social action over 8-9 years ago, because I saw that taking personal health action to sort of better my individual health, better the health of every person one by one by one through following great health advice, which I still espouse, was not going to be enough to create a healthy world and a healthy context for all of us to be, you know, to have well-being. And so that's what we talk about every week on this show. We talk to different experts, authors, advocates, policy leaders, thought leaders, doctors, scientists, book authors, filmmakers. The show has been going on for over 5 years. Please check out our archive as well, because we have a great group of guests who have loved to involve themselves in the deep conversation we always have about the issues on this show, and we also promote activism and engagement. It's great to do the right things for your health, eat healthy food, take herbs, and all of the great things that many of the people on Progressive Radio have espoused, principally, you know, following the leadership of Gary Null, who founded the network. But there's a lot more that we can and must do. I was the lead reporter covering fracking, the fight and the fight against it in New York State before we got a ban. And we've been carrying on since then, looking at all the things that we need to look at to really have a healthy society and a healthy world. And this year, that's never been more front and center as a theme than in the current political context before us. We're really being faced with a lot of choices. And I haven't made a secret of the fact that as well as I've covered fracking, I've covered toxic and endangering nuclear power plant at Indian Point. These have been covered in my blogs on Alternet, on Tom Dispatch, The Nation, Alternet, EcoWatch, and a bunch of other places, and I cover them regularly on this show. But in my view, if there was a single issue that I regard as paramount and most important for us to address, and that will be addressed in this current political cycle and legislative cycle, it is what I call the toxic trade deals. I've been covering them since 2014. More and more people, when we began, very few people knew about them. There was a near total media blackout, which we'll talk more about on the show. Now more people are aware of them, and not only that, but what they represent, I think, has gotten clearer and clearer and clearer and can more directly be talked about in the current political cycle, and that's what we're going to be doing on today's show. So I'm very excited to return, to have returning to the show, a senior trade analyst who's been with me from the very beginning of my reporting, whom I regard as really one of the premier on this topic, who's informed my own view and that of many other people. Glad to have him back again, and I'm sure this won't be, you know, he's been with us recently and he'll come back again. He's really a terrific expert in this area. He is William Warren, a senior trade analyst for Friends of the Earth, also an outstanding organization, very frequently featured on Connect the Dots. Bill works to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements, and he is he has years of service and knowledge, decades really, in this specific area. So for somebody like me who's come to this recently, and you know, after all of the fighting that we've done on behalf of fracking, on behalf of climate, and on behalf of having, you know, a healthy and sustainable world, all of the legal and technical complexities of these trade deals, which were kind of stealthily, you know, kind of introduced in Congress without full information to the American public. That very stealth and their very complexity, I think, really intimidated people and, you know, kind of led to people kind of going, well, the administration, President Obama, they must know what they're doing. And, you know, this must be okay if they're doing it. And as more of the provisions come to light, of course, we find out that they don't. And we find that out thanks to senior trade analyst William Warren and others who really have the knowledge and the chops to analyze what's going on with these deals and their provisions. So I'm delighted to welcome you back again to Connect the Dots, Bill.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
Today, I read a recent article that that you wrote that was published on Medium, medium.com, for people who would like to go read it. You know, you can Google Bill Warren, W-A-R-E-N, and read the article in full. And we're going to be kind of unpacking that article on today's show. One of the things that got me very excited about this article is that in the current political climate, in the climate of the current presidential campaign and primary campaign that we've been undergoing, there are things that we can now talk about, assumptions that people have made in the past that, you know, anything the government is doing must be for our benefit. Obviously, there are many, many groups that disagree with that who have been harmed directly by past trade deals and their terrible effect on the economy and on jobs and on many millions of people in this country who are very much aware of the negative past impacts of NAFTA and are not looking forward to the new round of deals like the TPP and others. But many more people have just kind of given them a pass, and I think there in this climate we can really talk about who these deals serve, how they came about, and the role of government collusion and the collusion of people working in government who come in on a revolving door from other places and industries, and in this case we'll be talking about who come in specifically from Wall Street, with other agendas that, you know, that really undermine the American public rather than serve them, and who, you know, and I think we can really ask the question very directly now, much more so than before, although it was always kind of there in the conversation, who do the trade deals serve and who is in, you know, holding hands with Wall Street to bring about deals like the TPP?
Well, you're raising a very important issue here, Allison. The revolving door has been a phenomenon at the U.S. Trade Representative's office for many, many years. And
he is the individual, and that is the office that is really the home for the deals in the U.S. government.
That's right. It's in the White House. It's not a separate agency, and the people who work there are regarded as White House staff. They're not subjected to the Administrative Procedure Act or a variety of other laws and structures that regulate ordinary federal agencies. And characteristically, the top person at the U.S. Trade Representative's office is someone who has been very close politically to whoever's president, often engaged in campaign fundraising, and then takes this position, which really allows them to reconfigure the whole regulatory state, especially as it impacts our health and our environment.
So the current U.S. trade rep, tell our listeners about who he is, where he comes from, and what he's about.
And the current U.S. trade representative is Michael Froman. He's a very bright fellow with a Ph.D. in international economics from Oxford and near the top of his class at Harvard Law School, where he met Barack Obama when they both served on the Harvard Law Review. And he was a major, after his period in academia and in the Clinton administration, He went with his boss at the time, Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin, to Citicorp. And at Citicorp, Bob Rubin and Mike Froman engaged in a lot of what many of us would call speculative financial behavior that was enabled by the deregulation of Wall Street that occurred during the Clinton administration that was pushed by Bob Rubin and by Mike Froman. Of course, this was a root cause of the 2008 financial crisis and the subsequent recession.
So let me ask you a question.
We, the taxpayers, had to bail out Citi after Mr. Rubin and Mr. Froman did their damage. But and then he goes through the revolving door again, and he's back
all
in
right,
the White
House. Before we go forward to that step, I just want to make sure that what you just said is like 100% clear. Basically, when we hear talk about Wall Street versus Main Street and the fact that the 2008 crash bailed out Wall Street but has left Main Street stripped and depleted, and you know, presidential you know, candidate seeking the Democratic nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders, has said that it's time for Wall Street to bail out Main Street. In other words, not to just take the money and run from the profits that now they're able to make since that time after having been bailed out, but really pay back the American people for what was in effect a, you know, a bailout or a loan to them that didn't trickle down to us. And that, you know, and so a key point in this current presidential campaign is how the decision to bail out Wall Street you know, now needs to be translated to Main Street. And so from what you're saying, Bob Rubin, it was in the Clinton administration that the Wall Street protections to prevent this kind of crash were stripped down. And Bob Rubin was one of the big players on Wall Street at Citicorp who benefited from and maybe even was instrumental in convincing newly elected President Obama to do those bailouts, and that's who we're saying is the former boss and sort of mentor of the U.S. current U.S. Trade Representative. Do I have all of that right? Because I just want to make sure it's spelled out
very
for all our listeners.
Precisely and concisely stated. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So these are the people we're talking about, and this is how it connects to the current legislative, you know, the current presidential cycle. Okay. So then we have Michael Froman. He's there. He's a former college roommate of President Obama. He's in Wall Street. So what role did he play in his old, you know, Harvard classmates' campaign to become president of the United States? What role, if any, did he play?
Well, first of all, he was a major fundraiser for Barack Obama's run for the Senate in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And then when Barack Obama decided to run for president, Mike Froman, in that 2008 election, was a major fundraiser. And, you know, they have to raise almost $1 billion to run for president these days. And Mike Froman was very efficient in what they call bundling campaign contributions from Wall Street and from the financial industry and related wealthy donors. And it was a major factor in providing the financing that's absolutely necessary if you're going to win a presidential election.
So, you know, in this era of, you know, what many have decried, money in politics, which came in with the Citizens United court decision, in other words, that there could be all of these donations, and many of them are not fully disclosed. We don't know what they are. We don't know, you know, one of the reasons there's been a call for transcripts from candidate secretary, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is because, you know, conversations are going on between candidates and major industries who are often their donors, and we don't know what has been agreed to or what has been, what, if anything, those kinds of donations buy. And so here you are harking back to President Obama's campaign and candidacy and election. There were, as you're describing it, his old college classmate, Michael Froman, was bundling monies for him. And, it used to be before Citizens United, and this is a point that journalist Glenn Greenwald has made, it used to be that any sign of wrongdoing or of impropriety was enough to kind of embarrass a politician, force a correction, need to be addressed. Now, instead, just as we've seen with the precautionary principle, which is an approach to health, it says, before we know that if it hasn't been proven not to be toxic, let's not do it, and then later ask the people harmed by it to prove that it is toxic. And that's what we have now, is a reversal of the precautionary principle in health, which you and I have discussed many times. It seems almost like the same thing has happened around money in politics. It used to be that that any sign of an impropriety was a problem, and now it's like somehow up to the public to prove that receiving billions of dollars or millions of dollars from all of these Wall Street and all these different corporations, to require proof that it influenced a candidate, which is hard to come by unless somebody was in the room eavesdropping or filming, as occurred with Mitt Romney's campaign, where he was secretly videotaped talking disdainfully to his donors about the American public. But, lacking that, there's no way to prove anything, and yet the demand of proof is suddenly like, the assumption is that it wouldn't lead to an impropriety, rather than it would, that it would be, you give a favor to me, I give a favor to you, which is, human nature and the way business is conducted all the time. So, here you're saying, so in this current cycle, there's much more scrutiny about what those kinds of relationships, what they really wind up doing to our policy, our government, our economy, and the American people, and indeed the earth and everyone in the world. But there has been this assumption that somehow they were okay. So there was much less scrutiny under when this happened with President Obama, and I think many people remain completely unaware that what you're talking about today actually happened, that he had a major influx of this cash, and that he had, was in any way kind of beholden to or mindful of the wishes of those who gave it. Well, what happens next? Now, Michael Froman went from being in Wall Street, where did he, he fundraised for the president, future president there. What happens next in that history?
Well, he was at Citi Corp, and then he joined, while still on the Citi payroll, he joined President Obama's transition team, where he was influential in getting many people appointed who were sympathetic to the Wall Street point of view, people like Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and so forth. And then at that point, he was given a $4 million bonus, so-called golden parachute by Citi, to actually join the White House staff. And he was in the White House working on international economic policy more generally. And then later in the Obama administration, he succeeded Ron Kirk as the U.S. Trade Representative, where he's been pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, trade deal, and a transatlantic trade deal, and a third one that very few people have heard about called the Trade and Services Agreement. And these agreements all are deregulatory in nature. In other words, they prohibit governments from taking regulatory action related to financial services stability or the environment or public health or whatever. And I want to emphasize that Mike Froman's done absolutely nothing illegal. He's a true believer, and he believes that in a laissez-faire philosophy that the market knows best, and if we get government out of the way, the economy will boom and the money will trickle down to everybody. Now, it hasn't worked out that way, but he still is a true believer.
Well, that theory has been in play since approximately 1980, because it was first introduced under President Reagan and his economic advisor of the time. And that's when it really became, you know, began to move in and become the dominant theory of how, you know, we should be conducting the American government and American business. So that's been 35 years. I know that your specialty is trade, but how would you characterize the last 35 years in terms of whether that theory has been borne out and what other, you know, more critical economists say about that theory?
Well, obviously, this financial deregulation in particular was the root cause of the 2008 financial crisis, which almost broke middle-class American families. Lots of people lost their homes, their savings, their jobs. It was the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. And apparently, Mr. Froman didn't learn any lessons from that experience. He seemed to regard it as a fluke, and he's returned to his belief in unfettered markets and the animal spirits of capitalism, so to speak.
It's very funny. So the pain that so many Americans are experiencing, the economic pain, the sense of the loss of the American dream, what we're seeing in the current political cycle where we have an outlier candidate, you know, or, I mean, actually the majority of people, if one calculates both how the vote in the Democratic primaries has gone and then adds in the substantial numbers of left-leaning independents, so one could really say, you know, the majority of people have been voting for a candidate perceived as an outlier candidate by the Democratic Party, namely Bernie Sanders, out of a sense of concern and disaffection with how all of this has gone down for people. And similarly, obviously more misguidedly, on the far right, the rise of Donald Trump to the likely Republican nomination is an expression of people's concern, distress, misguided fears, hatreds, and attitudes and bigotry engendered by the economic distress and loss of the American dream. So right now, in the current political cycle, we're seeing tremendous public unrest and dissatisfaction with the outcomes of this. So what is Froman and these trade deals, what are they proffering, you know, as a solution to our current problems in terms of these trade deals? Like what are they saying these trade deals will give, and what does history show that they will give? In other words, is there the same discrepancy between the belief in trickle-down economics and the hope that trade deals are and promises that trade deals are going to be so incredibly beneficial to the American public?
Well, I think there's a direct parallel. It's the same philosophy, and really the trade deals are really put in place the structure for the global economic system. It's sometimes been called a constitution for the world economy because it limits the capacity of democratic governments to regulate the private economy, and very intentionally so. And this is something that Mike Froman sincerely believes in, but some very distinguished economists, like Nobel Prize winner Joe Stiglitz, who also was a former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers in a previous administration, and even chief economist of the World Bank, as well as a famous academic. And Joe Stiglitz has said that these trade deals, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal in particular, is extremely dangerous because of the super rights, so to speak, that it provides to corporations and the ways in which it undermines our democracy and prevents our democratic institutions from engaging in the prudential regulation that will prevent future financial crises, but they also stands in the way of the prudential regulation to protect our water and our climate and the safety of our food, to protect our families from dangerous chemicals, and so forth and so on. And it's not a surprise that Mr. Froman is very much appreciated by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which speaks glowingly of his effort to get government off the back of business, quote-unquote. And, of course, the big oil companies are enthusiastic about his call for an expansion of fossil fuel exports around the world. And the American Chemistry Council, which is a euphemistic name for a trade association for manufacturers and exporters of dangerous chemicals and pesticides and insecticides, absolutely applauds Mr. Froman. And then, so it's not just the Wall Street Bank, it's the big corporations, not the small ones or the medium-sized ones, but the big global corporations that applaud Mr. Froman, and he sincerely believes that that Citibank and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Dow Chemical and Monsanto will lead the way to greater prosperity. I think they'll lead the way to planetary destruction, in my view.
So, yeah. Wow. Well, there are a lot of so these very parties that you're talking about are both applauding him, you know, giving him kudos, but they've also been the very same parties that have been at the table designing the provisions of the trade deals, while, you know, the American public has not been an onlooker, participant, and the outcome of that process was actually hidden from the American public and voters until it has been set in motion. Isn't that right? So these folks are there at the table, and the American public has been virtually shut out of the political process, and conveniently the media has also omitted, you know, the mainstream media has omitted coverage and mention of these deals.
Well, that's right. In fact, Mr. Froman has set up what they call an advisory committee process to assist the Office of the Trade Representative in negotiating the Pacific and Atlantic and other deals. And these are several hundred people from the private sector, overwhelming majority of whom are lawyers or lobbyists or executives with major corporations. And while these negotiations are going on, the text of the agreement's kept secret from the public and the press, but it's not a secret for the corporate representatives who are cleared advisors to the U.S. Trade Representative and actually participate in formulating the policies and even in drafting the negotiating proposals. So they're on the inside helping to, quote-unquote, cut these deals, while our democratic institutions, our legislators, our press, and the general public are kept in the dark until the deal is done. So it's, and again, this is you know, this is this process is quite open. You can find the list of who sits on these advisory committees and what their authority is, and it's shameless in a way, because you know it's not skullduggery. It's all the process is out in the open.
The process is out in the open, but the deal, our Senate and Congress voted to fast track these deals. In other words, to put them in a position where the president has the authority to sign them with a simple up and down vote by Congress. In other words, without discussion, without change, so that no change can be made in them as it now is. So their contents are basically locked down as of now. So we know who's negotiating, we know who's at the table. We can also talk about who will be enacting and enforcing them, and what role the people at the table will have in enacting and enforcing these trade deals. The American public did not have the full information. The press was not covering it at the time when this was an open question. And you know, when, for example, when we hear Secretary of State Clinton say something such as, they're not the gold standard that I would like to see, and this is the basis for her stated opposition currently, which is a reversal of her past position, but saying that they're not quite the deals I would like to see implies that, with a change here or a change there, the deals could be made into something that would be a gold standard. You know, it's like a reserving judgment. That would be that could be more meaningful if there was any ability to change the deal. So the public, which has been kept in the dark about the deals, would also need to know that the deals can't be changed to understand that the implication that I can make them really, you know, work for us and they're no good until I do it, runs afoul of the fact that they can't be changed. And I've always found that a kind of a bit of a bait and switch, because the implication is I'll make them better, but you can't. No one can make them better. It's up to the group that you're talking about to lock down those deals without that public input, which will never, ever enter the picture, because our elected officials will never have any further ability to tinker with the deal. You know, it's just kind of what it is. Your comments on that?
Well, yeah, it's under the fast track rules, quote unquote, its formal name is Trade Promotion Authority. The Congress has to give an up or down vote. And of course, it's hard for members of Congress to vote no when that vote is going to make it very, very difficult for them to raise the money that they need to have in hand in a closely run electoral contest, particularly in the U.S. Senate. So it's an insidious corruption, not illegal, but money is corrupting the political process, and this is nowhere more obvious than in the trade policy area.
The other thing is that on the one hand, because of the money in politics, our elected officials are beholden to these corporations who are rewriting the rules in a way that will have far-reaching global effects. And on past shows, we've discussed the effects on food safety, on GMO labeling, on the cost of health care, and most disastrously, on the climate, because of the wide promulgation of global fracking and gas and oil excavation, which these deals will usher in. But the other piece of it is, it's very hard for, because of the structure where the elected officials don't have any input, because, you know, it's kind of locked in and it's just, say, get an up or down vote, because of the fact that they're beholden to these very companies in order to get the donors that will help them be reelected. You know, at the end of the day, we have another problem, which is those who are not reelected in the current political cycle, perhaps because, you know, they haven't paid enough fealty to these corporations, perhaps for other reasons, they will, as of the election in November, be job hunting. They'll be, you know, going out, what do I do next? You know, there are no prohibitions on the revolving door between elected officials, regulatory officials, folks like the U.S. Trade Representative himself, who comes from Wall Street with money to the president, enters the White House, negotiates these trade deals, you know, and then he could go back to Wall Street and get another $4 million thank you gift or whatever. And the same thing would hold true for elected officials in Congress, both who are, and the Senate, both who are seeking to be reelected and those who do not get reelected who are looking for jobs. So there we will have those parties voting, giving that up and down, yes or no vote, you know, when they're job hunting and therefore through the revolving door they're subject to, they're looking for offers, and they could almost literally be bribed. You know, unless people take a strong stand, they could be bribed to passing, giving that yes vote for these deals, could they not?
Well, there's a lot of speculation that the vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal will come in what in D.C. jargon is called the lame duck session after the election. In other words, they're afraid to vote for the trade deal before the election because they might, you know, they might get tossed out. But then as soon as the election's over, they have some research that tells them that the public will forget about a vote after 9 months or 12 months or whatever. So it's been characteristic that they will vote on these trade deals in a lame duck session after the election is over, at least 2 years before the members of Congress will be held accountable. And they'll get their work done at that time and count on the public being forgetful. Although I'm thinking that the public may not be that forgetful now. I think that the public's aware of what's going on and increasingly willing to hold people accountable. And we'll see what happens in the lame duck session.
Well, we have to be prepared also for what happens and be acting before and ready to act and acting all the way through, basically, to let our wishes be known. We'll talk a little bit about more of that at the end of the program. But, one of the things that I wondered watching, because I actually, the time that they were voting on Fast Track, I sat and watched C-SPAN and watched the entire debate in the Senate and the Congress. It was a very low moment in American democracy. It was painful to watch. The irrelevancies of people, you know, giving a shout out to some local hometown group while, you know, this our entire, our right to protect our health, food, and the environment was being kind of torn down by these deals. That was painful to watch. But then there were other players, like, for example, Senator Ron Wyden, whom I wrote about on Truthdig extensively, who were big negotiators and champions. And I have wondered, and maybe you would know, you know, what kind of jobs await people who've done these kinds of favors in the new world order that these deals will set up? In other words, you know, maybe it isn't such a great thing to be, or won't, and it certainly won't be a great thing to be an American public elected official after these deals have passed, because one's hands would be tied on all different kinds of legislation that would already be predetermined by what's in these deals. So what kinds of jobs lie beyond for people who decide to collaborate with this?
Well, very characteristically, they It's not like the old days when Harry Truman went back to Independence, Missouri, you know, and had a rocking chair on the front porch of his modest dwelling. They characteristically go to work for big lobby groups or big law firms that are engaged in lobbying. In fact, if you look at Mike Froman's immediate predecessor, Ron Kirk, he was a lobbyist in Texas before he was appointed U.S. Trade Representative, and he was involved very much in negotiating the first half of the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific deal, and then for the second term of the Obama administration, he went through the revolving door and joined a pricey law firm, and he's very much a national spokesman for the nuclear power industry as well as the oil industry. And I know that you've been a real leader on the threat to New York City. Is it the Indian Point reactor?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so forth. But so Ron Kirk is out there trying to assure the elected officials and the press and the public that nuclear power is perfectly safe when it's anything but that. And it's just so disappointing to see that, to see what Ron Kirk is doing for the big money. And it's the same way for many of the senators who leave the Senate and members of the House who go after their time in office, again, to the lobby firms, to the big law firms that are engaged in political influence peddling, really.
So we've seen that Barney Frank, who used to be regarded as a great liberal, is now running a bank, and Howard Dean, who was, you know, a great liberal, you know, he's involved as well in, you know, in defending certain industries. So it almost becomes, the whole climate has shifted, therefore, and this becomes their kind of natural terrain and jobs. I mean, they're not going to get necessarily another government position, but these are the kinds of positions they get. And also, these are the people who are designated superdelegates, for example, in the you know, Democratic National Committee primary system. You know, distinguished elders, as you point out, might be in the past, they might be writing their memoirs or teaching at a local university or, you know, but nowadays they're lobbyists and they're working for big companies. This becomes part of, or they're, as in the Clinton Foundation, you know, they're kind of in the middle of obtaining government favors for their donors. I mean, so really there are many over the last, I guess, I don't know what it is now, it's like 25 or more years, a lot of this corruption has been normalized, and even as we regard, for example, the Democratic Party as good guys because of their liberal policies on domestic issues like abortion and gay marriage legalization and other good things, in this deeper background, which, you know, may not be directly visible as impacting the lives of, you know, the well-off, you know, and I'm not talking about gazillionaires, but, you know, just people who are still retaining a footing in the middle class, you know, it may not seem like a big deal, but as that base of who can maintain that footing steadily gets eroded, and, you know, people join the millions of others who are screaming about this, then we kind of have to look to this deeper background. You know, what from your perspective is the most egregious concern, tell, or, you know, example of this revolving door with, you know, the U.S. trade representative and these, and, you know, and the trade deals that will impact the American public if they were passed, in fact?
Well, obviously the Wall Street example that I gave you, but but also the connections to the fossil fuel industry, because, you know, the planet's at risk as a result of burning coal and oil and LNG gas. And yet, what do we see? We see U.S. trade representatives like Ron Kirk, who do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry while in public office, and then Kirk and his kind take fancy jobs in big law firms where they represent that same industry, and they're no longer on a relatively modest government salary. Mr. Kirk is making big bucks. He's come a long way from where he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how he sleeps at night myself.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the American dream of, you know, economic viability, which used to be theoretically available to everyone, although maybe that was, you know, not always so for people of color and you know, for many other communities. But it used to be, you know, I mean, the American dream was thought to be available to everyone, but now it's kind of morphed into this kind of dream of big rewards for really selling out the capacity of all Americans to participate in the American dream. So there's almost like this competitive scramble among people who, if they can get to the top of the heap, doing whatever it takes, whatever corruption it takes, whatever perversion of democracy it takes, whatever lack of caring it takes, whatever, if they can get there, they're the model of success. And I think Donald Trump is an example, you know, of that, although he didn't scrap his way there. He was kind of born into it and you know, kind of did what he could and floundered a great deal. But, you know, and then the myth is that somehow those people who are willing to do that will somehow be making wise decisions on our behalf, and that it will trickle down to us, you know, continuously. But the history of what's gone on economically over the last 35 years doesn't support that at all, and yet, you know, some people still believe it, and a lot more are waking up to it. I mean, the thing that's so interesting this year is that this is so much more of an easy conversation to have. What I find, compared with in prior years, I mean, I find that the millennials, for example, are very savvy about the deals and what they will do. You know, the environmental community, there have been many environmental organizations, yours, Sierra Club, you know, and others that have really been active in opposing the deals. But I find that on the ground, you know, a lot of environmentalists, you know, they have their core issue. They're trying to stop, you know, and I have it too. I have a local issue, which is, you know, shutting down Indian Point and the pipeline that they want to run through it. You know, we've stopped fracking and all of that. So, but, you know, there tends to be a focus on local issues. I want to protect my local river. You know, here's what's going on, you know. In Australia, where they had a big climate demonstration, you know, let's divest some money, you know, from the gas and oil companies. I mean, I'm all in favor of that. But, you know, this last year, the singular most key concern has been about climate has been reformulated by the meme, you know, keep it in the ground, keep fossil fuels in the ground. And yet, these trade deals are not going to keep it in the ground. They're going to excavate in every direction.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And mm-hmm. I'd like to, I mean, the font of wisdom, in my view, is Nobel Prize winner Joe Stiglitz, who, after his government service, did not go with a big corporation and make gazillions of dollars. He went to teach at Columbia University and then to become something of a public figure in denouncing what he observed when he was in government. And if I could quote him on mm-hmm. these trade deals, Joe Stiglitz said, quote, "The trade ministers get together and set the rules of trade. They don't worry about the environment. That's somebody else's agenda. Trade above all, that's the way they approach it. And as a result of that, we get a trade agenda that puts the environment and other concerns below. And mm-hmm. Joe Stiglitz, he's in the ivory tower, but he's speaking out to the American public. I mean, he was on PBS when he made that statement, and very boldly and forcefully challenged the way these trade agreements are despoiling the environment, and several other major economists and professors have also spoken out. And some of them quite conservative in their market philosophy, but outraged by the influence peddling that goes on in the crafting and passage of these trade agreements.
Mm-hmm. So we basically are at tremendous risk, if these deals pass, of perpetuating and worsening the environmental crisis. We're also at tremendous risk of another economic crisis. Could you sketch out what the concerns are there?
Well, there are provisions in the Trans-Pacific deal and the Transatlantic deal and Trade and Services Agreement that will make it very, very difficult to successfully regulate the financial services industry to avoid a repeat of the 2008 disaster. And it's in the text of those agreements. If any of your listeners want to get into the weeds, I can show them the legal language. If they want to get in touch with me at wwaren@foe.org, it's really wonky stuff, but it's very clear that the purpose is to subtly roll back the very modest reforms that were put in place after the Great Recession, and to allow free rein to the investment bankers and the other financiers.
Based upon what you're saying, while billions of dollars are being spent to run presidential campaigns and candidates, there's a vote. We're also voting on the fate of these trade deals. You know, on the one hand, if they attempt to pass the deals in the lame duck session, or at least the first one, they'll pass the TPP. The other two that you mentioned won't be passed in the lame duck session, but it will set that precedent. But it then becomes, but nevertheless, whoever is elected, president-elect by the time of the lame duck session, it becomes incredibly important. It both sends a message about what the American public is looking for here, if our voices can be heard and people are listening. It also, the next president will also determine the fate of the next two deals with their even more far-reaching, in certain regards, impact.
That's so, right. If Hillary Clinton is elected president, mm-hmm. she can stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal being passed in the lame duck session if she has the will to do so. Now, she says she's opposed to the agreement. Well, in 2008, Barack Obama said that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA and that he was opposed to these private investment courts and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And as soon as he had the nomination, he quickly made a 180-degree pivot. So I'm not worried about Bernie Sanders making a pivot, but I think that... I think that Hillary Clinton is getting the message that she's not going to be able to pirouette on the issues, if you will, in the way that she has in the past, because the public outrage is substantial. And frankly, I don't think they're going to get the TPP through in the lame duck, because I think the American people are informed and active and making their voices heard. And if they continue to make their voices heard, you know, this thing can be stopped. But, you know, that's the window of opportunity for Mr. Froman and Wall Street and for ExxonMobil and Chevron. They want to push these this specific deal through after the election.
Well, let's just talk about this a bit more, because I think it's really interesting. You know, if for myself and others, if you kind of wanted triple insurance as to the candidate who does not pivot, does not change their mind, you know, has been very clear about both the environment and this from day one, that would be Bernie Sanders. In terms of the other parties, you know, the minute the election is passed and at the end of this administration, Froman is out. So we're also, you know, there's a big issue about who the next Supreme Court nominations will be. Obviously, I'm not downplaying that. It's tremendously important because they're the ones who pass Citizens United. But the next president will also name the next trade representatives. They'll also be empowered to act on these other deals. So we're coming to the end of our time, I just leave everyone with that thought as events continue to unfold. And thank you so much, Bill Warren of Friends of the Earth, for being with me today on Connect the Dots and walking our listeners through this terrain. You know, please go to Friends of the Earth, listeners, and follow his terrific posts, the press releases, and all of the information that he generates out of Friends of the Earth. It's a terrific organization on so many different fronts. You can also take action through Friends of the Earth, through Global Trade Watch, through Popular Resistance, through Stop the TPP. If you're on Twitter, there's an abundance of information about that coming out all the time. You can also follow me on my Facebook page. Thank you once again, Bill. We'll be bringing you back to keep everyone informed about this as things proceed. Thank you so much for your many years of hard work, and may it all bear fruit.
Thank you so much, Allison.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for Connect the Dots. Tune in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy.